This is an RNZ podcast.
Nau mai, whakarongo mai ki te Aotai Whenua. Welcome to Country Life. I'm Sally Round.
Great to have your company. I'm Duncan Smith. Today, we mark the start of spring by celebrating the threatened Ngutu Kaka, or kakabeak flower, and meet a man trying to save them.
Later, we're at a farm with a real difference. The source for its produce is all around us. Farming salt from seawater the artisan way is surprisingly easy, involving buckets, barrels, and a good dose of Kiwi ingenuity.
And with winter drawing to a close, it's a perfect time to take our monthly whirl around the regions to look at conditions on the land.
But first, our guest this week is South Otago dairy farmer Stephen Crawford, who runs a milking operation with his wife Annabelle at Clydevale near Balclutha. Cosmo Kentish Barnes is with Stephen on the family farm.
We're organic A2 polled dairy farmers, and we're standing at our wintering shed set up and the silage pits, and there's a few cows in, not all of them yet. As soon as the weather packs up, we'll put the rest in, and they're fed 100% pasture silage throughout the winter and until they calve, and when they calve they come out of the sheds.
And you've got a big dairy farm here. How many hectares does it cover?
In total it's about 730 hectares. There's about 50 hectares of trees, all Douglas fir, and they're various ages, and we've got plans to plant about another 20 hectares, and then that'll be all the tree planting, all the gullies will be filled with trees then, and there's probably about 650 hectares effective.
How many cows do you run?
We're wintering about 840 this year.
And many years ago, your parents were farming sheep on this land?
Yeah, so when I grew up on this farm, when I was at primary school, this was a sheep farm. It was a bit smaller in those days. I think the farm was 160 hectares, so a bit of a change. Most of our district, or all of our district, was sheep in those days, and to be fair, most of it now is dairy. So,
So when and why did you switch to organic farming?
Seven seasons ago, we were in conversion for 2 years, and we've been fully organic for 5 full seasons now. And it really appealed to us. We've always been a low-input dairy farming system, so the shift to organics wasn't a massive mindset shift. There was a lot of extra compliance, a lot of rules we had to comply with. But it was kind of, at the time, and even now, it just seemed like a bit of a no-brainer, really, the way that things are going. We need to try to lessen footprint on land and that sort of thing, and organics really ticks all those boxes.
What did your neighbouring farmers think when you decided to change the farming system?
Oh, they were pretty intrigued actually. We used to have a lot of questions initially, but I don't have any, I haven't had any questions about it for years now. People just accept it. It's, I guess in farming that's the beauty with it, people can farm how they want to farm, and most people just accept it and they do something differently themselves anyway, so. Yeah, no, I'm pretty accepted in this district anyway.
What were the biggest challenges you faced in those first couple of years during the conversion?
I guess probably initially it was getting our head around all the rules and developing the systems to maintain all the rules that go around being organic. It took a bit of getting used to, like if you have an adverse weather event like a drought, like we've had a few in a row now, you can't buy in feed. It's got to be organic feed that you're feeding, so you've got to plan for the worst case scenario all the time, which means you've got to have a bit of a buffer up your sleeve the whole time, which initially took a while to get to the mindset of, but well, we're there now, so we've had a few droughts in a row now and we still seem to plug along okay, but we can't, you know, for example, we can't call in a palm kernel truck to fill a gap. It's just not possible, so we've just got to be fully self-contained and do everything ourselves.
Now let's walk over to the wintering sheds and have a look at them, because they've made a huge difference to your farming in the colder months.
Yeah, so we don't plant any winter feed crop, any kale or swedes or fodder beet or anything like that. Makes a huge difference to the cows, the sheds. You know, it's 5 degrees warmer inside the sheds. There's no sides on them, but just a roof. And they eat less because they don't have to spend energy making heat to stay warm, so they're pretty happy in here. They get fed twice a day. We feed about 10 kilos, 9 to 10 kilos of grass silage every day.
And the roof is clear?
Yeah, we've got 2 wintering sheds which have got clear plastic roofs. And we've got another shed, which is a tin roof. So yeah, the tin roof sheds, that's about 150 metres long. And the clear light roofs, there's two sheds, they're 100 metres long each.
Yes, quite an expense, but a good investment.
Totally, yeah, wouldn't want to do it now. The other thing too is, it's not just the wintering sheds, it's also the silage pits. They're quite expensive, they're big concrete bunkers. As you can imagine, we need a lot for that many cows for a number of months, so yeah.
And the cows are sitting on a wood chip base, aren't they?
Yes, yeah, composting barns. With organics, there's a minimum of so many square metres per cow, and on the side of each shed there is a 4 metre strip of concrete, and the cows walk out onto that, and then they put their head through a head bale and eat the silage that the silage wagon feeds out, and they do most of their pooing on that strip of concrete. So they keep the sheds pretty clean, and I don't know if I'd be wanting to farm dairy cows without the setup we've got for the winter, especially in our climate. I think it's it makes life pretty easy and pretty good for the cows.
You must make heaps of compost for the farm from these wintering sheds.
We do. We have a team of muck spreaders come in late spring, and they're here for a week, spreading it everywhere.
What type of cows are these?
Predominantly Friesian. We do have a few Jerseys as well, and we've used a lot of Norwegian red semen last mating, so we're having a dabble into that.
And milk production wise, how has your season been? Are these cows producing a lot of milk?
Yeah, they've done pretty well. This season's been pretty tough. We had a drought which started in January, so these guys have had a lot of supplement in their diet from January onwards. We started feeding them baleage, and then they were getting an awful lot of pasture silage as well through the milking season, which has definitely hampered their production. But you know, that's just farming. It's, you know, drought's a part of it.
Now, you get a premium for your organic A2 milk, and it goes to open country. What sort of premium do you get?
So we get paid farmgate milk price like everybody else, and we get an extra $2 for the organic and 20 cents for the A2. So farmgate milk price plus $2.20, and that's per kilogram of milk solid. So yeah, no, it certainly makes it very worthwhile.
Yes.
Yeah.
But now Open Country has decided to end the organic A2 bonus payments.
Yeah. Yeah, so we were told that in late last year. So with Open Country, we had a 2-year conversion contract and then a 10-year organic supply contract. And that's being cut short by 2 years, so it'll end up being 2 plus 8. We're pretty philosophical about it, really. We'll just see what doors open next.
Yeah. So what does that mean for your farming operation? I mean, will there be another dairy processor who will take your organic A2 milk?
Well, it's being looked at the moment. There might be one or two possibilities. We'll just have to wait and see. We really don't know as yet. I mean, a lot will depend on what happens with you know, around the world too. If the world suddenly picks up a bit, then that could change the game a bit as well. So yeah, it's pretty challenging times out there, and I guess that's had a bearing on that decision to finish the contract in 3 years' time. But we've still got 3 seasons to go, and we're just focusing on that, really. And if we have to convert back to conventional, well, it's not really a big change. It's just, we just won't be organic anymore, and we'll just carry on farming like we do. We'll still carry on with the low input farming system.
That seems a bit crazy though, after all the work you've put into developing this successful large-scale organic dairy farm.
Yeah. I guess the thing with organics is it's not something you just decide, oh, next week I might be organic. It's got a big lead into it. So yeah, it is a bit of a shame, but you know, nothing stays the same forever, does it?
Organic dairy farmer Stephen Crawford talking there to Cosmo Kentish Barnes.
Well, it's the beginning of the month and time for a look at conditions on the land. As usual, we've put in a call to our busy contacts right around the country, starting in Te Tai Tokerau, Northland, where farmers say it's been one of the kindest winters in living memory. There's been less rain than usual for this time of year. The markets are in good shape, with strong returns for store cattle. Calving has also been going well. Our agent contact says farmers across both beef and dairy are happier and more confident. Weather conditions continue to be mild in Pukekohe as winter draws to a close. Strong supplies of fresh vegetables have benefited the consumer, but growers have generally taken big financial losses. Later crops are looking good.
Waikato dairy farmers are in the middle of changeable spring weather as they near the end of calving. Good pasture growth means most farms are ahead of target, with supplementary feed reserves still high. Cow condition is good across the district and milk production is significantly up. Farmers are pooped from calving, but otherwise positive. Conditions are wet in King Country. Despite a drenching over recent weeks, it's been a brilliant winter, dry most of the way through. Our farmer contacts hard into lambing and has just sold some yearling cattle for a pretty price. Feed levels aren't too bad, though everyone's looking forward to more sun and a return to stronger pasture growth rates. Many Bay of Plenty growers have been busy at the horticulture conference held there this week. Many are talking about what a great winter it's been. The avocado harvest is just beginning and returns from the kiwi fruit season are just starting to roll through.
A hose from the heavens has been turned on Taranaki in recent weeks, especially this week. Those in the south are still quite dry though, and lower water table levels will be a worry leading up to summer. It's been a good winter for grass growth and feed is pretty plentiful. The warmer weather has brought bugs and bacteria growth, which has made calving a bit more challenging. Most dairy farmers are right in the thick of it. It's been a mixed bag for heifer replacements, but cattle prices are strong. Te Tai Rāwhiti East Coast farmers are feeling more positive after a few sunny days. It's the first time many have been able to get out on farm and do maintenance and cultivation jobs after the wet winter. Most farmers are ready for lambing with stock in good order and a reasonable amount of feed. The drop in interest rates is also good news, though commodity prices and high cost of sheep farming is still a worry for many.
In Hawke's Bay, grass is starting to grow again and crops are going into the ground. Some are well into lambing, though others have yet to start. Pregnancy scanning rates were down, especially in triplets, but those that have lambed did so easily and have had good survival rates. Stone fruit is starting to flower and there are plenty of daffodils about. Helicopters have been out already to protect young vines during frosts. There's been a bit of surface flooding across Manawatū Rangitike following heavy rain in recent days, but it's disappearing as the ground is still dry from the autumn drought. An ag consultant told us it's been an easy winter, with most farmers comfortable about feed levels. Calving is underway. Hill Country ewes have yet to start lambing. Store cattle remain very expensive. People are not expecting to make much from crops like wheat and barley this coming season.
Wairarapa has had a big turnaround after an autumn dry. A farmer based near the Tararua Range in South Wairarapa says he's had about 135 millimetres of rain in the last month. Overall, it's been a kind winter for growing grass and most farmers are in a better feed position than expected. He's not sure if this is due to warmer temperatures or if it's as a result of delayed autumn. Many are still under pressure though from poor returns on sheep and beef. It's a combination of depressed prices and high costs. Growers around Horu Whenua have had miles too much rain this winter, with north of 100 millimetres falling this last week. A grower says mild temperatures have been good for growth, but dull days have meant lesser quality. It's all go picking crops like broccoli, spinach and cabbage at the moment. Market conditions are very testy for growers, though. For consumers, vegetables are probably the best value he's seen for a long time.
Across Cook Strait to the Tasman district, where it's been mild with some good rainfall. Lambs are being born and have a flush of feed to help them get a good start. Dairy herds are well through calving. Things are busy at a Tapawera hop garden. They've been putting up the strings needed for the binds to climb up. The hop grower is expecting lower demand this year, so he's leaving some parts of the garden fallow. That'll save effort and having to return unwanted crop to compost. Calves and lambs in the Marlborough Sounds have been experiencing a mixed bag of weather, from severe winds and rain to sunny, calm days. A farmer at Waitui says they have fence repairs, track maintenance and scrub and weed control on the to-do list. Sounds residents are enjoying the road improvements, but there's still a lot more upgrading to do in time for the busy Christmas period.
On the west coast, a dairy farmer at Lake Brunner says the weather's been atrocious this week, with rain, hail and even thunder. In just one day, the rain gauge recorded 105 millimetres. It's not cold though, so grass is growing well. Calving started about 3 weeks ago and is well over the halfway point. All the cows calve in a dry wintering barn. It's a lot easier for cattle and staff. And weather's also been mixed in Canterbury over the past month. Windy nor'west conditions pushed up temperatures and chillier southerlies brought the welcome rain across the plains. Our contact at Hororata says farmers are hopeful they'll get a good spring to counter the dry summer and autumn, which cleaned out supplementary feed stocks and forced many to buy feed in and source grazing. Milk pricing seems to be heading in the right direction. Lamb pricing needs to do the same, as he says. It's truly in the doldrums.
A Central Otago farmer in Ida Valley was busy fencing when we called. He'd had 25 millimetres of rain on Sunday. It was sorely needed, as there's not much baleage, silage or grain left to feed out to stock. Merino and crossbred sheep are being shorn pre-lambing. Some farmers are continuing to dump coarser wool because strong wool prices are so low. It's just not worth bagging, pressing and sending away. Everyone's head down, bum up in Southland. Lambing's underway. Calving on dairy farms is in full swing. Ground conditions are soggy after a good dose of rain last week, but once things dry out, farmers will look at getting winter paddocks turned over and spring crops in the ground.
This is Country Life on RNZ National 101 FM.
To Te Tai Rāwhiti, the east coast now. And with the onset of spring comes a host of beautiful blooms and flowers. Janina Schwanaker caught up with conservationist Graham Atkins at his home north of Ruatoria, a paradise of protected native plants. There, she learnt more about one of New Zealand's most special flowers.
Just north of Ruatoria, on the east coast of the North Island, Graham Atkins Drive is a sea of colour. Though it's winter when I visit his collection of rare Nutukaka, or kākāpeak plants, the pinky red and white flowers are already starting to bloom.
Yeah, so this has been a reserve for 25 years, so before we fenced it off, like you could see straight through, so only the kānuku were here, all native.
We have a beautiful kākāpeak here as well, in full bloom.
I'm using them as the poster boy for threatened plants, you know, so if something like this kākāpeak, you know, you can't tell me it hasn't got charisma, if it can't, you know, turn people's sentiments towards our threatened flora, I don't know what else will.
Mm. And with the one we're looking at, which is taller than both of us, is that a fully mature one, would you say?
I think because it's growing on the edge, because they're margin dwellers, so they love the sun, so might get a little bit more height in it, I'm hoping. So that's probably 3 metres, so which is pretty good for a kākāpeak. So yeah, it's when you see the birds on them in the morning, it's just, you see all the reward for all of this.
And how long do they tend to flower for like this?
They probably go for a month, and so yeah, I'm just hoping this is only a pre-show, because we've got our kākāpeak festival in September and I want people to come and see the colour, hopefully.
Don't worry, you'll hear more about the upcoming Nutukaka Festival later. It's a conservation effort worth celebrating. Native to New Zealand and vulnerable to almost all pests, there are only about 150 kākāpeak plants known in the wild.
We're lucky I've got three different colour sets of kākāpeak growing around at home, and so we've got our local variety, they're red, and that's the Cleanthus maximus, and then we've also got the white and pink. So with the trend of kākāpeak over the last 20 years going from a couple of hundred down to less than 100 left now, we did a genetic study of all the remaining plant populations of kākāpeak, and no surprises that they're all distinct from each other, and that's because there's no gene flow between them. So yeah, so that's got some of those growing around here, and the pink variety, which is a blend of probably the red and the white to get the pink. So yeah, really, really excited.
Alive with the sound of birdsong, the native flora surrounding Graham's home is testament to how quickly New Zealand's native vegetation can regenerate when protected. It also serves as a testament to his many years as the Rohe's lone dock ranger.
Being a voice for voiceless was a big part of, big motivator for me, watching all the changes in our environment, in our tile, not being able to do much about it. So, yeah, just wasn't going to accept that. And, yeah, so it's just been the cage rattler, shaking a few trees, and hopefully, you know, for good and for positive change.
And how did your journey into conservation, into working so closely with Tao, how did that begin for you?
Yeah, I was lucky enough that my grandmother and my mother instilled a love of plants. On my mum's side, she's whakapapa's Te Mahi, a nuhaka, and rongo mai wahine. And in our whakapapa, we descend from a tohunga whose speciality was the medicinal sides of plants. So, yeah, I often wondered that where I had this this passion for our plants, where it all came from, and so I blame him.
What did that lead you to? You worked for Doc for a number of years, out in the bush, out in the field.
My first manager that employed me, he caught on pretty quick that I had a bit of a knack for spotting the unusual as far as our plant world. And so where others would see just a green wall, I could see that green wall, but something distinct would just stick out. And so go, oh, what's that? And go back and have a look. And yeah, I was lucky enough to have that ability to find a lot of our rare plants. And so not long into my doc career, I had the dream job of going around checking all the historic plant records for the Gisborne. Back then, Gisborne was part of the Hawke's Bay region. And so I check all the historic plant records and get to go back to those sites just to confirm or deny whether those species still existed there. So, and then, yeah, finding plants that were still managing to cling on was like finding gold for me. So, yeah, had a bit of a knack for the plants. And then when you get bitten by the tree bug, you sort of realise that some of these plants have been here for millions of years. Their existence is threatened by, you know, our actions. And then so there's a responsibility, I feel, to do something about it. And so that led into the restoration side of my mahi.
Yeah, your work, it followed you home, didn't it? And you have a beautiful slice of paradise here surrounded by any number of species of native plants. And can you tell me a little bit about how that came about?
Just working for the department, we were doing a lot of monitoring, so a lot of it was out in the Raukumara over a 20-25 year period. And the idea of monitoring is that you can show that there's something's having an impact on whatever. And so it was, we'd monitor the understory, because in conservation circles, the Raukumara was the last intact understory pretty much in the country. That was because it only had a recent possum invasion history, and the same with the red deer. They've only been here just recently. And so, yeah, we monitored the understory. And the idea with monitoring is that you can come up with the data to show this is the problem, this is having an impact, and then the bean counters are supposed to give us funding to fix that problem. But, yeah, it never ever came, so, or, you know, not at a level that was going to make a difference. Knowing how precarious the situation was for a lot of our species, not many people knew what was going on. That, yeah, I just saw it as a last-ditch attempt or effort to make sure that their, you know, these species continued survival. So you're right in saying that it's like Noah's Ark around here, especially for our plants. Yeah, I've got some real treasures that I've been able to, you know, get to grow and keep them here, you know, in the hope that one day we make their home safe again and that they can go back.
What are some of the challenges in terms of restoration of native flora and fauna here in Te Tairāwhiti specifically?
There are quite a few issues, but probably the main one is the prevalence of red deer. As time goes by, our young ones, you know, especially the hunting fraternity, are starting to call them taonga. It's a value set, so they, you know, fills a hole in the freezer. Where's what do they get out of the kākabīk sort of thing? And so that's probably one of the big issues as far as our taiao. And then we have our world famous erosion. I live at the bottom end of the Waiapu catchment at Tikapa, been here for 20 years living here, and every flood the bed rises higher and higher, gobbles up so much of our alluvial flats, all ends up out in the marine. And so we probably have no choice other than we have to do something about it. Otherwise, not so much our kids, but our mokos will not have a place to live here. At the rate of erosion and the aggradation of our riverbeds, yeah, those are the two pressing issues for our region.
Not one for sitting idly by, Graham sees building connection between people and te taiao as critical to the solution. It's why he's organised the very first Ngutu Kaka Festival, taking place in September.
Yeah, somewhere near the top, in the top three would have to be our Ngutu Kaka or our Kaka Beak. So there's less than 100 of those left in the country, but in the universe. So they only grow here, and half of that, or 60 of those, 100 grow here on the East Coast. And so yeah, the issue is when things become so rare that people no longer interact with them, so it's hard to get people to care about things when they're no longer in their lives. And and for me, Ngutu Kaka is such a beautiful plant, you know, really, really charismatic, and I sort of hold it up as the poster boy for our threatened plants in general. And so got a soft spot for our Ngutu Kaka. The whole gist of the festival, working on Kaka Beak, is that, yeah, how do you expect people to care about something when they no longer interact with it? So we started about a trust about 3 years ago, and we've been planting Kaka Beak at Kura and Marae, and so we've, especially on our side, on the Ngāti Porou side, and we've branched out in around into the Eastern Bay this year, and it's basically focused around Highway 35. What we want to be doing is we want to plant 1,000 Kaka Beak along the roadside, but not just anywhere. There's a lot of thought that goes into site selection, and so they're normally steep sites, and their associate plants are grown there as well. And so there'll be your hebes, tutu, karamu, and those species. And if they're there on the side of the road, that lets me know that, because those species are palatable as well to stock, to deer, goats. And so if they're there, that means that's not an issue. And Kaka Beak looks better when it's grown with its mates. And so we had nearly hit the 1,000 mark last year, but the cyclones came and, yeah, wiped a few of our sites out. So we're not going to let that slow us down. So, and the idea of those roadside plantings is the chances of Joe Public ever going in to see plants in the wild is pretty slim, because the plants in the wild these days grow on bluffs, cliffs and bluffs, and it's not so much that they like it there, it's just that the two main threats, which are deer and goats, can't quite get around to finish them off. And so seeing them on the roadside with, you know, with the associated species, it's probably going to be the next best thing to seeing them in the wild. And so having them on the roadside ticks so many boxes, raises the species profile. Hopefully we can generate an annual, we are going to have a festival this year, and hopefully it becomes an annual fixture on our region's calendar. When I show people the plants, and you know, they don't even know it's a native plant, and then when they find out that, you know, how dire things are, and that they're only X amount left, they're, you know, pretty keen to help out. And so our festival will be run along the lines of the Rhododendron Festival, and so it'll be over a 3-day period. Day one will be out where I live, and so we've advertised it as the nation's number one Kaka Beak garden, so
pretty proud of that.
Yeah, so it better be good. So I know there's some pretty sharp gardeners out there, and so it better make it worthwhile for everybody to troop up here.
That was conservationist Graham Atkins speaking to Janina Schwanaker at his home north of Ruatoria. You can see the beautiful Ngutu Kaka in bloom at the upcoming festival, which starts on the 18th of September and runs until the 21st.
Country Life, bringing you the sounds and voices of rural New Zealand.
Spring means lambs and new seed in the ground. And on an out-of-the-ordinary farm in the far north, the start of a new season, making a vital part of everyone's diet, salt. I met up with salt farmer James Moore, on a Northland beach one winter morning to find out what small-scale salt farming entails. And it starts off with collecting seawater.
So this is Cable Bay. So this was historically where the first cable, I think it came from Canada, arrived in New Zealand, the first communication cable, in about 1890, something like that. The store, which is there now, used to be the cable signalling station.
The idea of making salt came to James on a bike as he was delivering the mail 15 years ago. He'd become a postie after losing his business during the global financial crisis. He made his first batch of salt out of the waves crashing onto the beach at Raglan. Enough salt to realise his dream might just work.
And now you pull up with your trailer, and I can see some drums there on the edge of the beach.
There's three barrels. They contain 200, or can carry 220 litres of water. And it's roughly 66 buckets of water. I mean, every time I come down here, people say to me you should get a pump, but kind of like the simplicity of using buckets to run up and down.
How long does it take normally?
If it's on your own, it's probably about maybe 45 minutes to an hour. But if there's three of you, it's 10 to 15 minutes. Yeah, tops.
Should we get into it? I can give you a hand.
Sure. It's always nice when someone else helps. These are old olive barrels.
Perfect, so they are.
Perfect for the job.
What's special about the water here at Cable Bay, James?
To be honest, nothing really, other than it's doubtless bay. I used to, when I first started, I found a beach up on the Karikari Peninsula. If you see that hump in the distance there?
Yeah.
On the left-hand side of that is a beach called Puhiki. Beautiful, beautiful beach. And I used to go out there every day to go and get water. But we had a discussion with the iwi and they weren't too happy about it. It's quite a sacred place to them. So in the end, we decided to come back to the bay. And this is like 5 kilometres from home. I haven't got a coastal property, so this is a nice, easy place. It's just a little walk at high tide, as you can see.
Yep.
So, yeah, easy peasy.
So you always come at high tide?
I try to, yeah.
Just to make it a little bit easier for that run.
Sometimes I have people come and they'll book a visit. So when they come, and part of the experience is for them to help with the water run. And then I don't really care about the tide because they're doing all the heavy lifting, right? But if it's just me or one of the lads, then, yeah, high tide is definitely the best time.
So we're going to get our feet wet.
Yeah. Shoes off.
Shoes off.
So one of our little sayings we had in our business was leave nothing but footprints, which is why we use this. So there's no noise pollution, it's just a man in a bucket, really. And then it's just a question of popping it in the tank.
In it goes.
22 times per barrel.
And do you come out in all weathers?
I try to avoid the rain. If we get a lot of rain, it'll wash out through the rivers and the bay becomes a little bit murky. So we wait for it to stop, have a look at the water, and if you're happy, away you go.
Here we are again. Another couple of buckets going in.
It's such a nice quiet day today, isn't it? Not too many big waves.
Do you get many people sort of curious and wondering what you're doing up and down, especially in the summertime?
Yeah, I get lots of people come up and ask what the heck we're doing. A lot of them think we've got aquariums or something, but yeah, when they stop and we have a chat, invariably they sort of end up following us on the old social media or buying some salt from the Cableway store.
James's venture, the Taipar Salt Pig, took off in 2015, after James and his wife had moved to Northland, to the Taipar area. Here on 2 hectares of gorse-covered land, James set to building evaporation chambers. The salt farm was in production.
The very first evaporator we built was this tunnel house in the bottom paddock.
Uh-huh.
So my son and I dug a little platform out and we put a tunnel house on there and built a tank inside that could hold 3 of those barrels. just to see if it was viable or not. And lo and behold, we got, I think, 18 kilos of salt out of the first batch. So, yeah, it was pretty good.
And that's just a normal vegetable-growing style tunnel house.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we've blown up 2 thermometers in there, so it gets really hot in summer.
You've got quite a few trees around. So
well, therein lies the problem. So this was the first one we built. And 7 years ago, the trees were a lot lower. But now we've got the problem that they are way too high. And this thing now will only really work in high summer, when we get enough sunlight for the day. In winter, I'm lucky if I get 3 to 4 hours of sunlight a day. So we basically shut it down over winter.
You're not going to chop any trees down then? Or they're not yours?
They are mine, but I kind of like them. Don't you? They're probably pretty dangerous, actually. Okay.
Here we are inside.
Yeah.
And there is salt.
There is salt, yeah.
So plenty of it.
Normally, this would be full, and it'll take about, say, 4 weeks in here to turn those 3 barrels into salt.
And I'll just explain what we're looking at. It's sort of like a shallow pond lined with plastic.
It's a drinking tank liner, so for drinking water. So it's a food safety liner. When we recommission this next year, we'll put a new liner in to tidy it up a bit and make it look a bit better.
And basically shallow, and how does it work? Tell us what happens.
Simply, we park the trailer up here on the hill, run the hose pipe down, siphon the tanks into it, and then it sits there for, like I say, 4 weeks. Every now and again, I go in with a pool scooper and pick out what we can. And when it gets down to the last bit, the water kind of goes like a really oily, thick consistency. And then the crystals start to form. And then it's just a question of raking it into piles and letting it dry. And then this is our...
This is the finished product.
Very unsophisticated drying table. So basically, when the salt is harvested, we pop it on here and give it another maybe 3 to 4 days just to dry it a bit more. But you can see... One of the hazards of making sea salt is that you do get lots of little insects and bits in them. So we spend literally hours picking them out. It's one of the most hated jobs in the salt farm, but has to be done.
How do you do that? Because you can't really sieve them out, can you? Because they're smaller than the crystals.
Fingers it is. Pick them up, pull it out. And then we keep whatever we pull out, and we turn it back into a hot concentrated brine and turn it back into salt. So eventually you get most of what you originally harvested.
What about the actual water itself? I mean, have you had that tested? Do you know that it's pure?
I do. We've had the water tested at the start, and when you take it at the start, there is bacteria in it. I mean, it's seawater. So what we agreed with health and safety in the end was, look, we'll make the salt, and then we'll reconstitute it back to water and send that away to get tested. And that's what happens. It gets turned back into water. They test it, and it meets drinking water standards. Same with our other product, which I'm going to show you afterwards. We also make drinking water from seawater, and that product is the same. It gets tested and meets all the drinking water standards.
James says it's easy to make salt, but not that easy to make a lot of salt. Increasing production was the next challenge.
I mean, if you've ever been down to Blenheim, they've got acres and acres of ponds down there for making salt. And so we wanted to avoid that. So we came up with this different strategy, which was began up here in my garden.
So here we are. We've just moved up from the tunnel house, up onto a slope. And I really don't know how to describe this. I actually don't know what it is.
But it's kind of a greenhouse on steroids, but built into a wall, if you like. So when we came here, there's a retaining wall that was in place. You couldn't see it because it was all overgrown with cocuyah, but once I discovered it, I thought, well, this might be the perfect place to build more evaporators. So we started with this one that's facing at the front, which we call the North Wall, and we built that little greenhouse up there called the Crystal Palace.
Ah. And just describe what they are. They're little glass houses?
Pretty much,
on a slope.
Yeah, that's all they really are. They're north facing, they get a lot of sun, and luckily for us, even though those trees are pretty high over there, the sun arcs over the top of those quite easily. And so once we discovered that the North Wall worked well and the Crystal Palace, then we went on to the next level, which is that sloping bank behind.
It's about a 45 degree slope, and 8 bays there. So that added about another 350 odd trays that we could get in there with water. So there are plastic trays in there that can hold the water. Same process as the tunnel house, but what we discovered was that this was about a week quicker, so it evaporated quicker.
Did you know why that happened?
I think it's just the angle. I think for some reason, because the north wall is slower, but that banked one is just superb. So is the bottom one. We call the bottom one the Bonneville Flats. The big one on the top, we had a competition to name it, and one of our customers called it Gertrude the Glorious, so that's what she's named. But that pretty much gave us the capacity to make 60 to 70 kilos a month, all up, on the whole property, which is a nice amount, but still not enough.
Still not enough?
No.
Is the demand out there?
There's definitely demand for it. We sell everything we make, no problem. But the goal in starting this was to make a business that was, you know, simple, ecologically friendly, but it had to produce an income for someone to live off of. So that's been the goal all the way through.
And is it producing enough income to live off?
I think at 70 kilos with just salt, it's not the greatest income you'll ever have. But this is where the future development that we're going to go and have a look at now is what's going to, we think, change the whole system. So how that started was my neighbour, we're going to go to another property. So we've got two different families here now helping in the salt business. So Zav, my neighbour, who moved up from South Auckland with his kids and wife, he came and saw me one day and said he'd really like to work in the salt business. And I said, well, yeah, you can, but it's not really making enough money to sustain two of us. But I'd had an idea, having talked to customers at farmers markets, about capturing the vapour to make drinking water. And so we went in a completely different tangent in the first lockdown in between that. And we bought in a solar still to make drinking water. So that's where we're going now.
Now, well, just hang on a moment, James, because I actually want to go up here and have a look and
sure.
Just see exactly how it works.
Well, let's start in the old system.
Did you build this, James?
This is my veggie garden, yeah.
All the steps and the beds?
Yeah. One of the joys of being a salt maker is that you have a bit of spare time on your hands, so.
It's a waiting game.
Yeah.
We're in James's kitchen now, and on the trays, once brimming with seawater, there's just a layer of damp salt crystals.
So these are ones that have come out of Gertie. So you can see not all the water has evaporated, but the bulk of it has. So this next stage in this process is to grab a jug. I'll give it a quick tip up. So that any remaining water can just pop out. And then it's a very simple process. And you end up with, I don't know, 200 to 300 grams of fresh salt. Simple as that.
It's as simple as that. No added ingredients.
No, the only thing we do after this is it'll get some more drying down on that table. Then we'll pick it. And then we do flavour the salt. So we offer a range of flavours. Squid ink, citrus zest, garlic and chilli were my very first ones. Then we had a winter range, which was red wine, smoked, rosemary, and one other. It might have been togarashi, which is a Japanese blend. We've made Marmite salt, Vegemite salt. Zav, my neighbour, he's into cold smoking, so we're smoking salt at the moment. And we've worked on some Japanese flavours like yuzu, pickled ginger, those sorts of things.
Sounds delicious.
Yeah, it's good.
Do you use it in cooking yourself?
Yeah, we do. I mean, funny enough, I haven't got a shortage of salt, so.
Are you eating too much salt, do you think? Because that can be a health hazard.
Well, it can, but as long as you don't eat too much processed food, you're probably okay. So we always say to people, look, it's actually really strong salt. You don't need as much as you think.
Handmade and sustainable are values James embraces, right down to the hand-stamped paper packaging.
A certain segment of the population are sick of processed food and they want stuff that's handmade and natural. And I've got a real bugbear about how we produce food and how we distribute it at the moment. It's one of the reasons why I want to build a network of these around the country rather than scaling this up and making tons of salt and shipping it right down the country. To me, it doesn't make sense.
So let's go and have a look at the next stage of the business.
Yeah.
That next stage involves the Taipa salt pig and its sister label, Ocean Water. Besides the salt farm, James and his business partners have also been distilling seawater and bottling it in recyclable glass to give people a taste of Northland sun and sea. The water is desalinated and further filtered, all using just the energy of the sun here on site. Partners Zav Whitmore and Stephanie Nash live just next door to James, off-grid, with production all going on in their backyard.
So we've just come into your little sales office, I guess this is, or this HQ for
production office.
I'll get you to introduce yourself.
Oh, hi, I'm Stephanie and I am part owner of the Taipa Salt Pig and Ocean Water. My involvement is literally a lot of production and also sales at markets and things like that. And I've been involved with James and Yasmin for, a little over 12 months maybe? Yeah. With the salt side, with the water side, we've been doing that, myself and my husband Zav have been doing that for probably 2 years now. Yeah.
What do you think of the whole idea?
I love it. It's amazing. It's such a simple process, yet no one's doing it. And it's crazy because it's a resource we've got readily available. Salt water's everywhere around New Zealand. So
And you have the prototype there in your backyard?
Yes, we have the water and salt farm in our backyard. And so hopefully they'll start being more visible and people will be able to see the opportunity that will come from having one of these in your backyard. Because it's not just salt water. You can, you know, draw dirty water from rivers and streams or bores and make it into fresh water. And yeah,
wow.
So yeah, there is that as well as being able to use salt water and make salt.
Has that
so,
been done already?
Yeah, that's actually the purpose of the salt of the water farms in the third world countries, but over here we use it to make salt and fresh water.
James has shown us the various iterations he's come up with for salt making over the years, and he also showed me the separate off-grid desalination plant. Well, now in this paddock, the very latest, and it looks like an array of solar panels with little glass houses down the bottom, a system which makes salt and drinking water all in one spot, using gravity and solar power. And on top of that, James says it can be flat-packed to send to others wanting to set up their own little business.
Well, this is still a prototype. So on the top, you've got the water farm. So we're making water from seawater as usual. But now instead of having to take that brine up the hill to Gertie, we've built Gertrude on the front of the water farm.
So and it's an integrated system.
Yeah. And so this unit in summer should be able to make 2,250 litres of water and 100 kilos of salt a month. So we've gone from 3 to 4 weeks to make salt to 10 to 14 days. So we've doubled production. You put three units together, and if you can sell all the water and sell all the salt, suddenly you've got a really viable business in terms of income.
Okay, so let's talk about your new plan, James, because are you trying to replicate this around the country?
Yeah, this is my baby for expansion. So as we talked before about distribution of food, I want to make the salt in the regions it's going to be sold in and the water. And I think we can do that. And we want to do it on a cooperative basis rather than me going around the country and owning everything. I'd like to share what we've got with other people and give them all a little taste of what's a really cool lifestyle, really.
I was talking there to James Moore, a salt farmer in Te Tai Tokoro, Northland, and earlier to Stephanie Nash. She and her husband, Zav Whitford, are partners with James in the Taipa Salt Pig and Ocean Water. We put some photos of their prototype salt and water farm on our webpage, just in case you want to become a salt and water farmer too.
Well, that's it for Country Life this week. It's great to get your feedback. Do keep it rolling in. You can contact us at country@rnz.co.nz.
And you can follow and listen to Country Life wherever you get your podcasts. Do give us a plug on social media or tell a friend about the show by clicking the share button in this app.
You can read more and listen again to the stories you've heard by checking out our webpage, rnz.co.nz/countrylife.
The stories in this episode were produced and presented by Cosmo Kentish Barnes, Janina Schwanaker, and me, Sally Round.
And the studio production team today, David Knowles and Phil Bench. From me, Duncan Smith, bye for now.
Ka kite anō.